This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody. I think we might start now. Okay, so welcome to the National Museum. My name's Michelle Hetherington, and I'm a senior curator here. And I would like to welcome you to our 1913 lecture series. I'd also like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, past, present, and those on whose land we meet today. The 1913 lecture series has been devised by our public programs section to augment and support the Glorious Days Australia 1913 exhibition, which is currently on display in the museum until October 13. There will be 8 lectures in all in this series, and we've already had a number of really fantastic lectures given. All of the series lectures will be given by people who have contributed to the exhibition book, which is also called Glorious Days Australia 1913. Now, Glorious Days Australia 1913 is the National Museum's contribution to the celebrations of Canberra's centenary. But the exhibition, and of course the book, looks beyond the events of the 12th of March 1913 to explore the context in which Canberra's naming ceremony took place. It looks at what life was like in Australia 100 years ago, and at the events, beliefs, the new technologies, the attitudes of the time, and how they reflect the remarkable optimism for the future that was felt in that year, an optimism that, as we know, was about to come into contact with the dreadful impact of World War I. Okay. In curating an exhibition, there is only so much detail that one can sensibly include. Limitations of space and constraints of design inevitably mean that fascinating topics cannot be dealt with in the depth that some of us would like. And so, faced with the wonderful richness of our topic, we felt it was essential to produce an accompanying publication to supply that depth. We approached some of Australia's leading historians and subject specialists to draw on their knowledge and expertise. And we are very fortunate to secure an essay from Helen Ennis, who is our speaker today. Now, Helen is the convener of the Graduate Research Program at the ANU School of Art. She specialises in Australian photographic history and is concerned with finding new ways of thinking, curating and writing about photographs. Major projects include the exhibitions In a New Light, Photography in Australia, 1850s to 2000, Reveries, Photography and Mortality, and most recently, Things, Photographing the Constructed World, which was held again at the National Library in 2012-2013. Helen is also the author of an award-winning biography on the photographer Margaret Michaelis, came out in 2005. She's also written Photography in Australia, published by Reaction in London in 2007, and Wolfgang Sievers, published in 2011. She's currently writing a biography of Australian photographer Olive Cotton, supported by the Peter Blazey Fellowship and funding from the Australia Council Literature Board. She has recently been awarded the inaugural Australian Book Review, George Hipps Fellowship for an essay on Olive Cotton, which will be published in next month's ABR. And I forgot to mention as we were going through, this lecture is going to be recorded, and so your participation today is taken as your permission to record. So I'd like to introduce Helen.
Thanks very much. It's great to see so many of you here, and I'm glad you're here with me in the lecture theatre because it's cosy and warm. And it's a nice place to be on such a cold Canberra day. Thank you to Michelle, both for the invitation to contribute to the catalogue and to have the chance to speak to you today. So my talk is actually based on the chapter that I wrote for the Glorious Days Australia 1913 publication. It's this one here. It's a really handsome publication. And I'm greatly enjoying reading the essays in it. They're wonderfully diverse, and I feel I've already learned a lot. That was edited, in fact, by Michelle. So in the time together today, I want to do one main thing. instead of going back in time and looking at photographs and photography from 1913 to try and pull photographs and photography into our period and see which works in particular make that trip. And I'd like to think of photographs as time travellers, and some I think do it more effectively than others. So what I thought I'd like to focus on today is look at some of the differences then and some of the similarities between photography then, 100 years ago, and now. Now, I'm going to speak personally because I find that looking at photographs from the early last century is a very curious experience because they seem at once close and yet also far away. Their closeness comes from their modernity, or more precisely from the actual medium of photography, because we all know that photography was a product of the modern era. The rise of photography was the result of complex interactions between science, technology, art, culture and commerce, and was dependent on the radical reorganisation of society that came with the rapid industrialisation and urbanisation fundamental to modernity. So it fascinates me that while photographs, such as the one you see on the screen at the moment of roller skater Nellie Donegan, that these photographs from the early 20th century are modern because of their medium, and yet many of them appear also very old-fashioned and remote. I don't know about you, but I often find myself struggling with this because the look of these photographs and the outdatedness of whoever and whatever is represented in them calls up 100 years of separation in a flash. So in my talk today, I've included examples of photographs that for me stay locked in their own time, as well as those that somehow effectively reach across it. So the first task, I think, is to define then what kind of photographs and photography are we going to talk about today. You'll know from the exhibition that there's quite a range in the kinds of photographers represented, their interests and inclinations, and the purposes for which the photographs were taken. I'm just going to show you only three examples. So here you have Australian swimmers. Even their body shape is obviously so different from the swimmers that we see now, but the award-winning and very famous Fanny Durack on the left, and with another medal winner there, Mina Wiley in the middle, an English swimmer on the right. These were the champions at the 1912 Olympic Games held in Stockholm. And then an example of a celebrity photograph, the autograph photograph of batsman Victor Trumper. So celebrity, obviously, the sport, the things that are topical as well, and then photographs such as this, which we can think of as having a more governmental or official function, approaches to healthcare, and you can see them bearing their arms there, showing the what looks like very angry sight of a vaccination. Now, a quick overview of the period makes it clear that photography from 1913 was, in fact, very similar to photography now. Nearly all the principal areas of practice were in place by then. And this surprised me because when I was first doing my research, I was assuming that there would be many more fields of practice that have opened up since 1913, but it's not the case. Already by then, scientific and medical photography, forensic, anthropological, snapshot, amateur and art photography, formal and celebrity portraiture, they were all well established in the photographic industry. And photographs were beginning to be used more extensively in newspapers and magazines too, covering everything from topical events and sports to portraits and documentary photographs that accompanied non-fiction stories. So it seems to me that, in fact, there's only one obvious thing missing from photography in 1913, from that really diverse mix, and it was advertising photography. Because in the pre-war period, it was still illustrators rather than photographers who were continuing to provide the pictures and most advertisements that were published in newspapers and magazines. But that situation too was just about to change, as a listing in the Sydney Morning Herald in July 1913 foreshadowed, and I quote, "Wanted," in uppercase letters, "young, refined, good-looking lady model for photographic advertisement pictures. apply to Carey Studios, 310 George Street. So we're right on the cusp, in fact, of this transformation, because advertising photography, as you may well know, in the 20s was a hugely productive and financially rewarding area of practice. So what I thought we'll do then is look at just a few of the vital areas, and I'm going to focus on snapshot and amateur photography, anthropological photography we'll touch on, studio portraiture, expedition photography, and art photography as exemplified in the pictorialist movement. We don't have a lot of time together, so I'll whiz through some faster than others. So the first, then, is really where the title of my essay came from, this idea of the great spreading of photography. Because by 1913, the democratisation of photography was really well sorted. So this revolution, then, in what we think of as the democratic applications of photography that get a manifest in snapshot and amateur photography, they began in 1896 with Kodak's release of a pocket camera. So, you know, in the next 20 years, that had an amazingly pervasive influence. Prices for cameras varied, just as they do now. But what interests me most is that the features of those cameras are pretty much the same as they are now. They've persisted. The early 20th century, cameras were small, lightweight, so that you could be mobile with your camera. They had automatic exposure settings and direct viewfinders. They used roll film, just generally then 8 or 12 exposures, which meant that they could be loaded in daylight. In the past, of course, you had glass plate negatives and you had to insert them in the dark and everything was much more complicated. But this idea then that we have of our cameras being so portable, so small, so adaptable, was actually something that was already really very present in the early 20th century. But what's also striking then is that the normalisation of photography as an everyday activity was pretty much complete by this period. Kodak, as you'll see, exhorted its customers to carry your Kodak with you always and take Kodak pictures of all those happy incidents that turn up when least expected. So the commercial developing and printing processes or the services that were available in that time made it even easier for you to push the button and let them do the rest. So the staple fare of snapshot photography was and still is familial and social life at home and on holidays. The small commercially processed prints were incorporated into domestic narratives and albums such as this. This would be a very standard album of the period. And this, in fact, was stock and trade until the advent of digital photography. It's really only in the last 10 years that we moved away from albums to keeping our family photographs on computer and digital files. Now, I want to make a distinction then between snapshot and amateur photography, because it is quite clear in this period that those two areas of practice are seen to be separate. Snapshooters were enthusiasts. I think of them as people like me who are not trained but are really keen, you know, to get photographs of the kids and so on. Amateurs were enthusiasts as well, but they were much more serious about perfecting their craft. And the amateurs are the ones who consciously strove to make better, more artistic pictures, flagging their seriousness of intent with the titles that they gave the photographs that they exhibited in amateur exhibitions and so on. Titles like The Waiting Cab, Dawn, The Old Mill, Where Stillness Reigns. You can see even from that sort of choice, the literary allusions here, that a lot of thought is going into the titles. But what's particularly impressive about amateur photography from the early 20th century is the structures and networks that supported it, because they've persisted as well. You'll know that from amateur photography clubs and societies that are still with us today. I think these, in some ways, are more important than the work that was produced at the time, which often looks formulaic and rather tame. So it means then in the early 20th century, in the amateur photography circles, you had these admirably strong, educative and inclusive principles. Photographic societies and camera clubs, along with a very healthy range of publications, fostered the exchange of information and technical know-how. And I think that the number of photographic societies and clubs is really quite startling. In September 1913, Australasian Photo Review, it was a little publication but very influential, it listed nearly 70 societies and clubs in Australia. New South Wales had the most of any state, with 32 in total. So I think that's very impressive. And it was in these clubs then that you brought together amateur photographers and professionally trained studio photographers who gave technical instruction and feedback on members' works. Now, Harold Kasner, who was one of the leading photographers in this period, already established before World War I. This is a photograph by him called The Ship's Cat. He was someone who was at the photographic societies giving advice to people on the prints and helping them to improve what it was that they were doing. So his demonstrations and lectures were very, very popular. As an extension of these activities, he had an entrepreneurial streak quite clearly, because he also offered postal and private tuition and criticism, advice and coaching. So Harold Kasner ran an ad in 1913 which proclaimed that on receipt of one print and a postal note, a detailed letter of criticism and advice together with the submitted prints will be promptly returned. So I think that is a great, for me anyway, a legacy of the early 20th century, this educative and inclusive thing. I mean, Kasner was thinking of it as an entrepreneurial activity there, but in the clubs he gave his advice very, very freely. So Australasian Photo Review, that magazine that I just mentioned, it held competitions for juniors and adults and published a huge range of practical articles that gave instruction on all manner of subjects: how to retouch your photographs, how to copy them, how to use developer properly, how to take marine photographs, and so on. And each issue included a page of the editor's frank, succinct comments on entries that readers had submitted for competition. In no case was the individual identified, so you didn't have to feel mortified by whatever it was that they said. Only the initials were given, along with the suburb or town where they lived. For example, E.K. Wingham, Dogs was obviously the title of his photograph, hopelessly underexposed and unsuitable for competition. So they didn't mince words. And some of the feedback I find very amusing. In one issue from 1913, the editor advised A.F. Long of Longville in Sydney that, and I quote, "We put an embargo on any more prints from you entitled Argyle Cut. The one now sent in is excellent, but we can't keep giving prizes for the same sort of subject." So they clearly had a recidivist, this person, AF of Longville. But very rigorous quite trenchant criticism of the entries that were submitted. So amateur photography then was also really important for people involved in other areas of work, such as exploring, geology, ornithology, all sorts of scientific areas. And I'm only going to give you a couple of examples. One is Francis Birtles, who took numerous snapshots while on his bike and motoring trips around Australia. And then he used those photographs as illustrations in the articles that he published in different kinds of magazines, such as his Lone Hand. So here is his Oldsmobile, you can see packed to the hilt. Here is his travelling companion, Buster. Unfortunately, though, I don't think Buster can have had a long life on the road, because there is a small photograph of his grave which looks to have been in a very desolate spot way out west. And then also travelling by bike. So his colourful account of his experiences in northern Australia in 1913 described the difficulties in printing photographs in hot makeshift conditions. I think it's extraordinary that he was able to take the photographs he did. But, of course, it's reliant on that technology that I've already mentioned, the small, lightweight camera. So he describes trying to develop his film and make his prints, and this is a quote from him. "Perspiration trickling down my nose onto the papers, mosquitoes stinging furiously, and other things kooijiing in the developing dish. Washed the prints in a creek, but shrimps ate the surface off." So it was clearly very difficult to be on the road and trying to bring home your prints for publication. So for anthropologists too, cameras were an indispensable aid in the study of Aboriginal people, and that had been established earlier in quite a formal mode. But what we see then in the early 20th century is the accompaniment too of works that are much more informal, using these small format and then handheld cameras. So you get more naturalistic representations where Aboriginal people are photographed in situ outdoors rather than being brought, for example, into the studio. So the activities in which their subjects were involved began to be shown in process rather than being suspended or staged for the camera. So it's quite a different mode. So I would use some of these anthropological photographs then as examples where photographs come out of their period and connect much more easily with us now. And these examples that I'm using are by George Aston, that Philip Jones from Adelaide has done a lot of work on, because for me these still have a very contemporary presence, even though they're in black and white. This is called Winnie and the Kids. Kids obviously referring to the goats, photographed in 1912. George Aston, who took this, was a policeman, storekeeper and ethnographer, and he photographed extensively in the area around the Birdsville track where he was located. So the immediacy and directness of his images are striking, but it's their narrative power, I think, that is especially noteworthy, because here Winnie is being pictured with the goats the Astons kept for milk, and she looks directly at the camera while one of her curious charges rises up on the ramshackle fence at the right of the composition. Now, why this is important formally is because it's not in the amateur photography that you see a kind of radicalisation or revolution in photography's vocabulary. It's in snapshot photography. And so those kinds of impromptu things that happen in the more informal, relaxed kind of cropping that goes on, that comes from snapshot photography, and that's had a huge effect right through the 20th century into our own time. This is another example by George Aston of tribesmen at Mungjirani in 1912 demonstrating the method of fighting a duel. So in the left-hand corner there you see that image of the shadow of a dog. Now, that's what I mean by the kind of radicalisation of photographic seeing that comes from snapshot photography. But in Aston's case, it's showing then that the photographs he's making are drawn from the flux and activity of life, his life, in fact, as much as anyone's. So the next area we'll touch on then is an area that we are all familiar with, because these photographs by Frank Hurley that came from the Australasian Antarctic expedition that Douglas Mawson mounted 1911 to 1914 have been very much part of our image bank right through the 20th century. So it means that some of the best known and memorable groups of photographs of this period of 1913 were actually taken in Antarctica. It's significant that Mawson appreciated that photography and filmmaking could play an indispensable role as part of the scientific enterprise, because of course that's why these men are going to Antarctica, but also as a means of popularising expeditionary work and recouping some of the considerable costs involved. Mawson knew that they had to make money, and by taking along Frank Hurley on this particular expedition, he knew he would get the footage and photographs that he would be able to sell. There was a lot of dispute, in fact, between Hurley and Mawson. They weren't necessarily the best of friends, and some of that was to do with ownership of the necks and so on. But this is a photograph by Hurley of the Aurora, taken from the Aurora as it's steaming through pack ice. But what's interesting from this particular expedition too are photographs taken by the scientists. This isn't a Hurley, And so it means then that Mawson, he took 8 cameras for his own use, and he also appointed the official photographer, that was Hurley. So it means you have 2 very fertile streams of practice occurring simultaneously. Amateur photography on one hand, and photography for entertainment and popularisation on the other. So Mawson's own documentation of his team's life and work is straightforward and invaluable. But I think that occasionally his results or the works he makes yield poetic results as well. And this is an example, I think, of that. It's from the National Library's collection. It's a frost-covered spectroscopic camera, where I think the singularity of his focus and the isolation of that subject, so that you just see the interaction of the something made by a human and then the natural world interacting with it, I find that particularly satisfying. And then this is another example. So not taken by a professional photographer, but you see here a compass appearing on top of a delicate snowflower. Again, the human world and the natural world being brought together into an aesthetically pleasing interplay, yeah, between the complex naturally occurring form and the scientific instrument. So, yeah, on that trip it meant the work being the amateur photographs being taken by scientists and so on, and then photographs taken by Hurley. This is an example of Hurley's work, because he was someone who was thoroughly embedded in the whole history of Australian photography through his own training. And he worked as a postcard photographer before he went to Antarctica. So he very much knew what the public was interested in. He always had that sense of what would be popular. So here you have him taking a photograph of the men, of the some of the scientists working there in a workshop. The kind of natural outdoor photography that he did there of penguin, and then the icebergs. So it means then, I think with Hurley especially, it's his engagement with the icebergs and the unusual ice forms that is most memorable. In expedition photography then, especially of polar subjects, I think there's a close association with wonder, because of the revelation of what had hitherto been unknown. And Hurley really exploited the unfamiliarity and strangeness of Antarctic scenery, which everyone wanted to know about then, and I think still now. It's wildlife, the icebergs and ice formations, to great effect. This one is actually called Ice Mushroom from the library's collection, as you can see. But for Hurley, securing a negative was merely the first stage of an image-making process defined by constant and continuous reassemblage. I'm not going to go into that, but I want to point out that this is another version, in fact, of the turreted iceberg that you see a beautiful carbon print of that's in, from the National Gallery of Victoria, probably in its original frame that's in the gallery in the exhibition, Glorious Days. It's worth rushing down just to see that alone. But it meant then for Hurley, getting the negative was just the first stage. All sorts of things could follow on from that. Here it is in the version of a lantern slide, which is something very different. It projected and could be projected huge and had all that wonderful luminosity and otherworldliness. Hurley described himself as a showman, and he incorporated these different forms of photography, still photographs, composite prints, these coloured lantern slides and so on, into his lectures and live performances in order to maximise visual impact and physical sensory experience. That's why Hurley, who still looks old-fashioned in some ways, is actually very contemporary in others, because of this desire that he had to stimulate your senses, to create theatre around photographs and around photography, to actually really try and make as many connections with you as possible. Art photography then. So art photography had already been well established too in Australia in this period, but it meant that its establishment was not only slower, it's the area of practice was smaller than in some areas. What Burke said, Walter Burke said in 1913, he was the editor of Australasian Photo Review, was still a puny growth compared to some of the other areas. As he saw it, having a small population, because Australia only had about 4 million people at that time, remembering that Indigenous people weren't counted in the census. And he also saw it as a problem that that small population was scattered across such a large continent. He felt it made it difficult then to assess the progress of art photography in Australia. He noted that it took 3 weeks just for a Sydney correspondent to get a reply from Perth. So he felt that tyranny of distance as being operating within Australia. He was a New Zealander, by the way, so he came from obviously a much smaller country where it seemed easier to hook up with the other photographers. But that said, art photographers were very ambitious in intent in this period before the First World War, and they did, from my point of view, consciously enter into the web of international exchange and influence. Despite those geographical and temporal distances, they were in constant dialogue with photography and with photographers overseas, especially in Britain and to a lesser degree the United States. And this degree of interaction in the pre-war period is greater and much more complex than was long assumed. I'm not going to go into it here, but we always assume that in the colonies, you have a derivative model in the centre. Is somewhere else, and that the exchange was one way. It was much, much more complex than that, the way modernity was understood. So the way it plays out in photography is actually a really interesting story. But I'm just going to show you some examples then of the art photography that Australians were doing at this time. And this example on the screen is by John Kaufman, who had travelled to Europe himself and then come back. It's called something like Grass and Trees, which is surprising because a lot of the images do have much more literary and suggestive titles. And this, in the exhibition, there's a vintage print by Harold Casnow, who probably was, the most eminent pictorialist photographer, his Razzle Dazzle of 1910. Now, it meant then that people like Casnow and Kaufman and all the other art photographers were very familiar with the work of their international counterparts, either through travel or through magazines and journals that were published overseas and devoured locally. But they also held exhibitions in Australia of international work and had been doing so for decades. Casnow was someone who had a lot of success in the international salons. Just like his predecessors, he sent his photographs away, and he debuted, in fact, at the London Salon of Photography to much acclaim in 1911 and continued to exhibit there annually until 1952. So that's no mean achievement. That, for a photographer, to show at the Royal Society in exhibitions or the London Salon, that was the pinnacle of your achievement. Olive Cotton, that I'm working on, that's what she said. In the 1930s, that was the height of her ambition to have her works shown there then. So Casnow, he never travelled overseas himself, but he regularly contributed to these international exhibitions and publications. This is his photograph, The Bent Tree, from 1914. Now, the style of photography then, of art photography, that people like Casnow were promoting, is known as pictorialism. And its exponents were called, often derogatorily, the fuzzy wuzzies, because they didn't want sharp focus. They actually went for this very generalised, soft focus, oldie-worldy effect. So low-toned, impressionistic, and so on. And using a lot of handwork and manipulation to align their photographs more with printmaking and with drawing. Now, pictorialist photographers have fared relatively poorly in photographic history over the last century. They've been dismissed for not appearing modern enough in either subject or style. But what I would argue is that, in fact, photographs like these do have a contemporary resonance because of the idea that's now commonplace, where we think of photographs not just as images but as objects, objects that have material properties. And so the surface of photographs, the texture of them and so on, is appreciated much more these days. And pictorialism self-consciously makes an appeal to lovers of beauty and other forms of art. So all the different printing techniques that they used and their nuanced soft colours actually slow down apprehension of an image. They're created to cause the eye to linger. And there's a lot of interest, contemporary interest too, in slowness, in quietness. So I think the pictorialists have something to offer there. Now, the last section that I wanted to talk about was portraiture. I will just make this point about not only then pictorialism's appeal because of its sensory, physical, material properties, but also an argument for long-term relevance, which might look odd, because what Harold Kasnow and Walter Burke argued is that we should strive to excel on distinctive lines by creating and maintaining a type of pictorial work that's purely and singularly Australian. So even though these might not look typically Australian, what might not be what we expect now, pictorialists actually wanted to, in atmosphere and treatment, create things that were very distinctively national. So what they saw then as being crucial, the way that you could define that, was it was all to do with sunshine, that Australian art photographers should work with the sun. Burke said that too many amateurs have endeavoured to show Australian scenic subjects plunged in gloom, and that they felt then an alternative approach was required, that to do justice to Australian scenery, workers must learn to make pictures in sunshine that will, when exhibited, show sunshine. So you just see the beginnings of that before World War I, and then, of course, that follows right through where people want to give you a sense of the glare of Australia and the particular qualities of light, and especially that's evident in the work of Max Dupain and others, our modernist photographers. So the final group of photographs then I'll look at, it takes me back to a comment that I made at the beginning of my talk. It's about the remoteness of many photographs from a century ago. And remember, I'm talking personally here. So I'm going to look at some portraits to elaborate on this phenomena. This is Rudolf Buchner's very lovely, she's called Louise Lovely, in fact, of the portrait of the actress Louise Cabas. Now, portraiture continued to be a mainstay for professional photographers in 1913. Using Walter Burke again, he said that the studios, the photographic studios, were in excellent health in this period. And this is a quote from him. The prosperity of the country generally has helped them to win success financially. And there are magnificent studios in every centre throughout the states. So that's where the photographic industry was really flourishing. A lot of professional photographers had their own studios, and then you would go there to have your portrait taken, and that would be their mainstay. But the magazines, as I mentioned, were just beginning to be significant market players as well, reproducing photographs of celebrities. And I'm showing you some examples by May and Minor Moore. They were two New Zealanders who moved to Sydney in 1910, pioneering women in this field. And they're represented in the show with some really lovely celebrity portraits of musicians and actors. And then these kinds of photographs were reproduced in magazines like Lone Hand, either illustrating articles or announcements. So this is opera singer John McCormack. And here you have English soprano Maud Percival Allen as Brunhilde. This is from Wagner's Ring Cycle. Clara Butt and Kennelly Rumford. Now, I know from reading this marvellous catalogue that Roger Neal, he's written on about music in this period, that Clara was an English contralto and global superstar. So I wouldn't have known that, you see, were it not for the essay. And her husband was a very accomplished baritone. Now, what I want to just go back to then is what I said at the beginning, that I struggle with some of these photographs made a century ago and my lack of connection to them. I can see how pretty they are and how accomplished they are too, and how, in fact, in relation to a lot of other portraiture from the time, May and Minor Moore's work does excel. But using these ones then just as a case study, I think that some of the lack of connection comes from the following. They're brown tones, which are no longer in use. We associate sepia with a bygone age. We're much more used now to seeing our portraits in colour. The figure's poses and photographer's point of view, where the full figure is often represented within the frame, and the photographer doesn't come in much closer than that. So this of itself creates a sense of distance and of decorum, in fact. And then there's the averted or indirect gaze of the subjects. So they either don't look at you, or when they do look at you, interestingly, the mode of address to the camera, even if they're looking directly, is somehow reticent. So what I wanted to do is not that fair on them in a way, but just to show you what I mean is that if you compare our photographs of celebrities with some of those from 100 years ago, of actor Cate Blanchett, of the Queen, taken by Polly Borland, who is an Australian photographer, and then showing you how that photograph then has been reproduced in magazine style, and then of course someone like Nicole Kidman. All I've done is, and I had a great deal of fun doing it, was try and find the sort of celebrities from the acting and musical professions in the way that May and Minor Moore might have, Nick Cave and Paul Kelly. Paul Kelly photographed here by Martin Filby for The Age in 2007. So our celebrity portraits superficially look very different. They're much more likely to be in colour. They're much more likely to involve relative close-ups of the body and of the face, so that the photographer has moved in much, much closer, so you don't get that physical distance or separation from them. And of course they're constructed to convey something quite different, that the address of the subject to the camera is to give you some sense of engagement, but it is of course a mock intimacy. And that's it means then, I think at first glance, portraits such as these, we just start there with Cate Blanchett, look very different. They don't have the decorum of the Edwardian period, which to me seems so polite in the exhibition. And what these ones do is they owe a debt to fashion and advertising photography that were the areas precisely not developed 100 years ago. And yet for me the question arises, are these contemporary portraits any more revealing of their subjects than those by May and Minor Moore? So my aim today has been to discuss some of the differences and similarities between photography in 1913 and now. I've wanted to give some brief historical context and show briefly how some things remain the same and others appear to change significantly. But ultimately, what fascinates me most are those photographs that leap 100 years to connect with us now, that enter into a dialogue with our present and our time. What, why, and how they do it. Thank you.
Just ask Helen to take a seat over here, because we're now going to have a chance to have some questions. Now, because this is being recorded, our staff have microphones and they will actually pass the microphone to you. So if you can wait until you've got hold of the microphone before you start asking the question, that'll be fantastic. Are there any questions? Lady up the back.
I was wondering, Helen, that was wonderful. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why. I noticed that on one of the photographs there was the photographer's signature, and that was the people from New Zealand, the sisters from New Zealand. And I was wondering, were they sort of superstars in their own right? Or, you know, why did some people sign them, and actually how did they do it? Thank you.
Now, that's a great point, because in the 19th century, photographers, you would see that they would have their own studio stamp, but you don't see a lot of 19th century material signed by the photographer. So what you've put your finger on is this idea of the photographer and the studio, the whole authorship thing beginning to become important. So there were always studios that were, you know, had outstanding reputations, that if you wanted to have your wedding photography done, you would go to that one in particular. But it meant then, yeah, around this period, the individuals are claiming through signature a higher profile and begin to sign on the fronts of photographs. And they do it in pencil, or they might do it in pen and ink. But that tradition, in fact, is something that's still very much with us now, where even to value photographs now, it means that if something has been signed, you know, the signature has a cachet with it. It will actually endorse or even enhance value if something has been signed, yep, that way by the photographer. So how they did it, yeah, just usually pencil or pen and ink. And it's interesting, even if we use Max Dupain as an example, who's 20 years later than that, but he would write onto the photograph itself, not below the photograph. But that meant that even at, when you had your mount, you would still see his signature because it wouldn't be below. So he's really making it obvious that he's the star there as well.
I was going to say, May and Minna Moore were extremely extremely effective and popular photographers, weren't they? Because they'd started off in one city and then were able to spread.
Yes, that's quite right. So they had a studio in Melbourne and a studio in Sydney as well. Pretty unusual for women at that stage to be as prominent as they were, because women generally had been supporting others in studios. So, yep, they had a terrifically high profile, and you can see that their clients were really the best of the day. So their business thrived.
Mm. Another question.
Thank you very much, Helen. That was really excellent, and I really enjoyed your talk. We're doing some family history, and it spans, obviously, mainland, but also Tasmania, including overseas. Was photography particularly well developed in Australia compared to perhaps Europe? And if so, were there photographs that actually chronicled how just ordinary people lived? And that's a very good example of, you know, workers or people who actually worked the land, and that was obviously the vast majority of people who started off living in Australia, whether it was in the mid-19th century to the 1913s. Thank you.
Well, in fact, I think you can say unequivocally that Australians have had a love affair with photography right from the start. Within a few months of the invention of photography being announced on the other side of the world, there was a bloke on a boat with a camera, turns up in Sydney, takes some photographs. So it just meant that it really didn't take long at all, and that right from the start, Australians were really engaged with what photography could do for them. It's just that our own history is a very particular history, and what I've tried to argue in the research that I've done is that you don't look at English models and American models and European models and Asian models to try and understand what happened here. You have to look at the circumstances and particularity of our own history and our own experiences. And what's clear is that in the first decades of photography here, it was usually itinerant or travelling photographers. We didn't really have our firstborn generation till later in the 19th century. So the photographers, the first ones, they came and they went. Off they went again on those very boats back to England and the States or wherever they'd come from. So it took a while for our photographic, our native-born photographers to flourish, but it didn't take more than, you know, a few months, as I say, for photography itself to flourish here. And the number of studios, they just grew exponentially. There were hundreds of studios by the 1860s right across Australia. But the democratisation of photography, where, you know, what you're describing, where people chronicle everyday life, that really isn't until the early 20th century that that begins to happen. Until then, photography is much more in the hands of professionals or people who had some money behind them and were able to get the technology and the access to information. So they needed a good education and so on. Yeah.
And there's some really interesting hybrids like Corkhill, who obviously wanted to be a professional but ended up, because of his milieu, taking what are like snapshots of the locals.
Yeah. Yeah, so Corkhill that Michelle just mentioned, there's a wonderful collection of glass plate negatives in the National Library's collection by Corkhill. We've had a really fantastically rich history, but what I've tried to argue is it's a vernacular kind of history too, and when people come with preconceived notions about, because if you go to collections in Europe, England and America, what you'll find is that there's an argument that the photographs from the 1840s and the 1850s, the whole noble, heroic, early stages of photography, these are the backbones of collections, the most important works. And then if you look for those in Australia, not only will you not find them, but what you find is instead is something quite different and so deliciously scrappy and ill-formed and ad hoc. So our early traditions are quite different, but, you know, are hugely invigorating and interesting. That's why you have to understand what was in our circumstances, the circumstances of colonisation that gave rise to the particular practices that we have here, which I have endured too, because you go and look, our photography still, in many, many areas, has a very distinctive flavour, even in this age of globalisation.
Thanks very much, Helen. When we look at the work of Frank Hurley and his great talent to Photoshop his work, I guess, for a modern comparison, was that something that was a challenge to Hurley to gain the acceptance in that media at the time?
Now, you used the word Photoshop, and I meant to say that because I think if Frank Hurley were alive now, he would have gone mad for Photoshop. It would have made everything so much easier for him. So there's a couple of aspects to your question. The first is that what Hurley did, that composite negative, because he would make a number of composite negs and then bring them together in one print. Now, that wasn't uncommon. People have been doing that for decades because they often couldn't get a dramatic sky and the early photography would come out very flat. So they'd have a negative of wonderful cloud formations, then take the photograph of the city, put the two together, bingo! You know, you had the perfectly formed and much more dramatic representation of something. So he wasn't the first to be doing composite printing, but he, I guess where he attracted a lot of controversy was using all his composite and early photoshopping stuff, all his forms of manipulation, and calling it documentary, because for a lot of people that wasn't accepted as documentary. But I think Hurley's take on documentary is actually perfectly sound. What he said is, there's a great quote where he was on the battlefield in Flanders after he'd come out of Antarctica. It must have been the most amazing conjunction to have been in the snow white, you know, marooned in Antarctica for years, and then he says he's on the blood-red battlefields in Flanders. He said if he just took a normal neg, it just looked basically like people were out for a picnic. There was no drama in it. And he had to, in order to give people a better sense of what was happening, to be truer to the scene, he needed to have a number of negatives to communicate that. So I actually, I'm sympathetic in a lot of ways to his take on documentary. And yeah, I think you can see it as being quite contemporary. As long as you know that they are manipulated, as long as when you look at a newspaper now, that the byline says digitally manipulated or something, so you don't accept it as verbatim, but you realise that someone is still trying to show some version of the thing as it was.
And even this one's digitally, well, not digitally, this one's been manipulated, hasn't it?
By Harold Kasnow. Well, Kasnow too, he was someone who always had a drawful of skies and that, but he did not only a lot of manipulation before the final print, after the print if he were making his pictorialist images by using, choosing paper. Like, if you look at pictorialist images, you know how we often think of photographs as just having an emulsion that's flat and one-dimensional? Photographs don't give much that way. You look at pictorialist images and they choose all sorts of textured papers. And so you get, much richer surfaces and so on because of that. So Kasno is one of those where you want to look at how it is he manipulates the final form through all those sort of techniques as well.
Do you have any advice for us in looking after our photographs, which are now close to 100 years old?
Okay, two things. One is you've got to keep them in the dark, and the other is you need to keep them dry. But if you have colour photographs, like my kids now are in their early 20s, and I had some snapshots out the other day from the 1980s, and they've already shifted. So with that colour photography from that period, the dark and the dry are not going to keep them stable. It's just inherently unstable. Slides, you probably know, colour slides were much more likely to endure than the prints. But if you're making prints now, then of course you can ensure that you can make things that are much more archival than those commercially processed colour photographs were. Yeah, so I think the hardest thing to keep photographs sound is if you live in the tropics, because then, you know, things just go so mouldy and awful. And that gives rise to, you know, different ways of dealing with photography. It's been, a question, for example, in Australia is, why did we not have a lot of expedition photography out in the deserts and so on? And compared with the American West, why have we not got that tradition? It was simple. It was, in fact, to do just with the weather. It was too hot, and the photographers couldn't coat their glass plates and couldn't deal, you know, with the instant congealing and so on that you would have got. I know research that I've been doing on post-mortem photography, I couldn't understand why there didn't seem to be post-mortem photography coming out of Queensland in the late 19th century. And then someone pointed out to me that the bodies of the deceased in Queensland in the 1890s, they had to be buried really, really fast, usually within 24 hours, so that there wasn't even time to get the photographer in. So all these conditions that we have in Australia that will affect the nature of photographic practice and what it is that has survived for us. Yeah, so that's an elaboration, but certainly in the dry and in the dark.
Well, once more, I'd like to thank Helen for an absolutely fantastic talk, and I hope you'll join me in thanking her.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.